The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week for the final time before he has his spine fixed is James Baggett. James, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, John. Nice to see you for the last time for probably 6 or 8 weeks. I think it's about time we had a little bit of a break. So I've decided to engineer an operation just so we can have some separation, John.
Oh, it's a very kind and expensive thing to do.
Well, we've had quite a week, haven't we? We have had quite a week.
We have. Do you want to tell the story of you trying to buy a Qashqai?
No, let's start with our little visit to Tom Hartley Jr., which is the supercar, classic and supercar dealer that we went to yesterday for the latest installment of our Selling Supercars video. What a place. I mean, it was just absolutely staggering, wasn't it? We've seen a few of these ultra high-end dealerships before, and I wasn't really expecting it to be quite as amazing as it was, but we walked into a very nondescript industrial unit, got buzzed in through the front door, and then just to be greeted by this array of amazing cars. Tom Hartley Jr., we reported on his results recently and spoke about him on the podcast. He made £20 million profit from the sale of 77 cars in his last financial year, which is frankly amazing. And we had a tour of his showroom. He took me out for a drive in a Ferrari Dino that he's just repaired, just reconditioned, and had sold. But it was just some of the cars in that showroom were amazing, weren't they? I mean, there was not one Ferrari F40, but there was three. One of them, his own personal car, and the personal car was quite a special F40 because it was actually delivered brand new to one Stirling Moss, Sir Stirling Moss. There was correspondence between Sir Stirling Moss and Enzo Ferrari about the order.
Basically saying, I'd like an F40, please. Can I have one?
And Enzo saying, of course you can, Stirling. Which, so he's got all of the correspondence with this car. He was due to take me out for a drive in it, but unfortunately the heavens opened and it just would have been an absolute boyhood dream. I mean, the F40 is like my most favourite car there is out there. So I was absolutely gutted about that. But the Dino was a nice replacement, but not quite the same. But yeah, he showed us around his showroom. And we sort of glossed over some of the cars, didn't we? We had a LaFerrari 918. Mm. McLaren P1, the holy trinity of supercars, modern supercars. And we just sort of kind of ignored them at first because the array of stuff he had there. I mean, the one that really stood out for me was that Aston Martin DB4 Zagato. I think he said it was one of five. He's just come out of a 2.5 year restoration, up for sale for £14 million. £14 million, and it was just stunning, wasn't it? Every single part of it was like brand new. And he was an absolutely fantastic chap, wasn't he? He was a really, really genuine guy. I think it's going to be an amazing video, and just the stories that he had. He knew everything about these cars, as you can imagine, like absolutely everything about them, including this. I mean, I'll just tell the story about that F1 Niki Lauda car. Niki Lauda's six Grand Prix winning Formula One car that he sold in January of 2020 in the eight figures. He wouldn't tell us exactly how much it was, but he sold it to a collector just before the pandemic. And he said to this guy, don't worry about paying me. You can pay me in a couple of weeks. It's fine. And then Boris Johnson came on the TV and said, we're all locking down, and the world kind of shut down. And Tom said, I just never expected that car to be paid for. Lo and behold, day later, the multi-millions arrived in his bank account. And the guy rang him up and said, well, yeah, you know, I wanted the car, obviously wanted to pay for it. You know, I'm an honourable person. He said, can you hold on for a little, hold on to it for a little while for me and I'll pick it up soon. 4 years later, it's still sat in the showroom, £10 million or whatever this car was.
I know.
Still sat there. I mean, it was.
And the funny thing is, Tom says, I would give him, you know, did he say millions, a couple of million in profit just to have it back?
Yeah.
Have amazing. It as his permanently.
Amazing. But yeah, I mean, let's introduce our guest first. And then then I'll tell him the story of the Nissan Qashqai purchase yesterday. And he can give us his take on it.
So our guest this week, fresh from our last video on the AI car dealership? I think it was. It's Alex Bradley, founder of Small Cars Direct. Hello.
Hello. Good to join you.
Nice to see you. Your face has been playing out on our website for many days in our video player, which I think I said to you earlier today, 500,000 people have seen this month so far.
I thought it was a glitch. I thought, well, you know, when you've got cookies on a site and it knows you're interested in something, it just keeps targeting you. I thought it was just that, but no, actually.
Yeah, you're just really interested in Alex Bradley.
Yeah.
Seeing you.
That's it. Very self-involved. Yeah.
Not a mirror. Alex, let me just tell you the story of how one of my car purchases went yesterday, and then you can give us your take on whether we did the right thing. So John and I went to pick up a Nissan Qashqai that we bought from... I'd bought from CarWow. 10-year-old Nissan Qashqai, listed with full service history, was in pretty good condition, nice kind of blue, like that purpley blue colour, so a bit better than the ones I bought in the past. Went to pick it up, started having a little look around it, and things didn't really add up. So the first thing, there was lots more marks on there that had been listed on every single panel. Then we opened the boot, and in the boot, underneath the floor panel, there was a puddle of water. And the lady told us, oh, yeah, well, it has been raining a lot recently. Thinking like, yeah, but it's not supposed to be inside your car. It's not supposed to be inside your car. Then there was a lot of rust in the boot. Like all of the kind of metal was rusty. And then the back seats, we lifted up a bit of carpet and I could sort of push my finger through some of the metal that was in the boot. So clearly it had been leaking for some time. Then we popped the bonnet open, had a little listen to the engine. You could hear one of the belts making a really kind of whistling noise. And at that point she said, oh yeah, the cam belt does need doing. Meanwhile, John was looking through the documentation and the cam belt was advised to be changed to her by the dealer last in 2019. And since then she'd done about 30,000 miles.
And subsequently on every single service since then, changed the cam belt, getting progressively angrier, actually, I would say, these mornings in the service.
Strongly advised on the most recent one, yeah.
But we turned up. So we turned up at this house, and it was like quite a posh place in Oxfordshire. And they had this big drive with like kind of, you know, what's it called? Like a pond in the middle that you had to kind of drive around roundabout. But parked all the way around the outside of this were lots of 10-year-old SUVs. And John and I immediately went in there, you know, completely suspicious. Detective John and James. This must be a car dealer. This must be a car dealer selling this car. And why are they trying to get rid of it? So we sat there for the first couple of minutes on the government website, checking the tax of all these vehicles. Say, well, if they're not taxed, they're definitely in the trade. So, yeah. And there was like two or three of them that were all, you know, the ones that we checked were all taxed. So we jumped.
Because they haven't bothered to do the V5 change of ownership for the poor last owner. That's why, because that's showing there.
This is what we thought. So we said to the lady, you've got lots of cars. I mean, there was literally 10 or 15 of them there.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, yeah, they're not ours. We've got a swimming pool out the back and it's kids' swimming club day. So they were just all these mummies have turned up with their kids in their 10-year-old SUVs. They weren't for sale at all. But anyway, so that was...
It's me like going, I'll check the address on company's house.
We were ultra suspicious, weren't we? Ultra suspicious. But anyway, we looked at the logbook of this Qashqai. And the first owner was a kind of workshop repair leasing company that does all the kind of hire cars when your car's been in for crash repair.
Yeah.
And it was at that point we just went, look, I'm really sorry, but I don't really think this car's for us.
Well, there was a lot more than that, wasn't there? There was some weird. So you had the sun blinds for the panoramic roof, made some nice crunchy noises and didn't go all the way back. So that was going to be a problem. There was a weird thing where at the top of the, let's say the where the boot lid meets the rest of the car, all the paint had rubbed off. So it was just through to the body in white. So I don't know if the boot had been misaligned for some time and it was scraping against it or something. There's a little bit of surface rust there. There was just a, oh, and then needed new brakes. That was also in, advised in the service a year ago, but you could feel them, couldn't you? It was very...
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where you could sort of think about, like, you could chip the price for one of them, but when you added them all up, it was the kind of like, we're going to have to offer you half the amount of money we've paid. And even then, I don't really want to buy your car. So that's said, I'm really sorry, but I don't think it's for me. But it's just, I find it really hard to walk away from cars when you've agreed to buy them and you've sort of already in your head got them in stock. So when you actually make the effort of going there, you're trying, I don't know whether it's just me, but I'm sort of fighting with myself whether to buy it or not.
And no, I'm the same because you feel like you've already bought it, right or wrongly. You should probably try and delete that sort of, you know, mechanism in your brain. Cause you need to be really, you need to be like, you know, you need to be really on the ball, don't you? And just not be committed until you've actually paid her the money. Cause otherwise you may let your kind of decision-making go a bit awry when you're there. But it's hard to do that because obviously you've planned this, you've made efforts to make travel, you've gone with John, and you've probably even maybe added it to Portal already because you want to get ahead of the game and get it live. So like us, I'm always looking for ways to buy it, even if there are a few things wrong with it, because that investment, you know, time and money that you've already laid out. But like you say, I think it gets to a point where it doesn't really just come down to money. Sometimes you're starting to think about, hang on a minute, this is actually going to take me 2 or 3 weeks to get it on sale. You know, there's time implication as well, isn't there? So you're probably right to draw the line.
Yeah, it's just sometimes I find they just don't feel right, and it didn't feel right from the start, and it just got progressively worse. And I don't know whether I talked myself out of it, but I just find it, this is the thing. I'm trying to wind down ahead of my operation because it's obviously just me selling the cars. But this week I sold the Kia Picanto that I had in stock, still got the Skoda Fabia, but I've got a leader.
I'm surprised.
Someone's coming to see it tomorrow from Poole. So I'm hoping that she's going to be keen, but I was trying to
and see my blue one on the way back if they don't buy it.
I'll send them your way.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, I've been trying to wind down, but then this week I've agreed to buy 5 cars. So it hasn't really worked. I've got the bug. This is the problem.
Good. This is it.
Yeah. So, Alex, tell people a little bit, rather than me bang on about my business, tell people a little bit about yours.
My business started on the side whilst I was working at Nissan head office. Just had a fun car as well as the boring Duke and Qashqais that were allowed on the employee scheme. Had a, like an Integra Type R and then a Clio 182 Trophy, and that was it. I thought, well, this is fun. I can have a nice fun car as well as a boring one. And then eventually I got another job. And then when I left there, I had about 4 cars in stock. And then I decided it was time to go full time. That was 2015. Down in Hampshire, specializing in small cars. We've now got, I haven't got 48 in stock. We've probably got about 33 online advertised now. We've got how many of us? There's 4 of us now. I've just taken someone on, technician. So that's going to really help get things sped up and turned around. Yeah. So really fortunate. He's only been with us for the week. So that should help massively. So yeah, it's going well.
How many do you sort of sell a month?
Varies quite a lot, as you can imagine. I think we had our worst financial month anyway in December and our best financial month in January.
Right.
Which is absolutely crazy since inception. Yeah, we had our best and our worst ever back to back. So we sold, I think December we sold 13, and then I think we sold 28 in January. So that's pretty much the broad spectrum we could do, maybe 12 on a really poor month, and maybe 28, 29, I think is the best we've ever done. So anything in between.
Where are you picking your stuff up from? Where do you get your stock?
We get it really quite a broad mix. So you could probably argue that sort of 25% for each avenue. So we advertise locally, so that's probably about a quarter. BCA is probably the other quarter. Well, I try not to promote those guys as much as I need to. So that's half. And then, yeah, probably Carwow, Motorway is the other quarter. We actually started buying locally from a local auction house over this last month, which has actually been going quite well.
Is it?
Like a smaller local one. So, you know, went first week, bought six, went the next week, bought two, and then bought five the other week. So see me picking up a few each week that way.
And what are they like when you actually get them back? Are they as described?
From the local auction place. To be honest with you, I've only really fallen foul with a handful of them because of my own excitedness. And what I've learned is it's really elementary, but when you're watching the car being driven into the auction hall, if you peer over the driver's shoulder to see what lights are on the dash or what lights aren't on the dash, on a lot of the cars, you can't actually see a full view of the dash unless you are really peering in. So yeah, there's a few lights I've missed, which is a bit embarrassing to be admitting that, but it's true. But because we've got a technician in this last week, actually we've been turning some of those around quite quickly. So there's not been any big disasters. And I just like the fact that you can literally just drive at least one of them away there and then yourself.
Do you?
And then their delivery turnaround, the auction's on Friday. I'm having the rest delivered on Monday. Brilliant.
Oh, brilliant. And what's the auction hall? What's the auction house?
Southwest Vehicle Auctions.
Right.
In Poole.
Not too far away. I might have to pop down.
No.
Yeah, come on. I think that's the next. That's another video brewing, I think. They are 55 minutes from us, other side of Poole. Yeah.
And what sort of stock do they genuinely sell? I mean, is it stuff from local dealers or?
Yeah. So I think they've got a handful of main dealers that they've worked with for quite a while. So they've got a couple on the Isle of Wight, I think. The Isle of Wight, in terms of them disposing of their part exchange vehicles, they're probably quite limited. They just have to get rid of them off the island no matter what. I just think to get any decent money for them, they have to. They've got no option. So I think they must have a contract with the big guys on the island, the Isle of Wight, Northwood and Leslie's. I think they might be the same people, but that's them. I think Howard's group. So they're quite a big one, aren't they? If you look at the sort of dealers they cover, I think it's pretty much all of them, all the non-premium brands. Howard's have got all across the Southwest, up to Bridgewater, Bristol. Yeah.
What sort of money are you giving for these? Is it kind of line with cap or?
No, I'm giving over cap. I think I got laughed at on Friday. There's me and one other bidder online for a couple really old small autos, and I was not going to be outbid. I was determined. I think they started bidding off at like sort of 400-500 quid on a couple of these cars. And in my head, I had sort of 1,700 for them, 1,800 quid for each of these two cars, simply because I saw the retail being way over what even Auto Trader would say, way over cap retail, just because I feel like I know the market for that sort of stuff. I was being laughed at. It was just me and this one other guy online, and people in the hall were just looking at me like I'm some sort of crazy idiot. But I'm paying way over for a lot of it, but it's because I feel I know the cars are actually worth more when I'm transacting at the end of it. So I'm not put off by that at all.
So what's going well for you at the moment, stock-wise? I mean, obviously, small automatics. I mean, it's something that I've been trying to get my hands on, and they're near enough impossible.
Well, this is it. I think people are looking at the guides too much on those and thinking, oh, I'm not going to pay that for it. And then you end up missing out. I think you literally just got to have faith and trust in your gut feeling, really. It's the same in any end of the spectrum. I suppose you probably have that same conversation with, you know, Tom earlier in the week when you're talking supercars. It's the same even down at the dregs of the car world. I think if you've got a good feeling for something, I think you should just get it and use it as a trial and see how you get on. So yeah, it's anything sub 10 grand at the moment. I had the same conversation with somebody this week. Our average value of stock over the last sort of 18 months has gone from around sort of 12,000-13,000 pounds a unit down to, I think, about 7,000 or 8,000 now, just because I feel that that's what's moving quickly.
Right.
It's not really where I want to be because the turnaround time for prepping is so long, but for as long as they're moving and we're kind of negating any risk in seeing them in person at auction and car wow and all the rest of it, that's what I'll continue to do, I think.
Can I ask, at that sort of price, sorry I'm interrupting, but at that sort of price, how many people are wanting finance? versus average?
Yeah.
Good question that, John, because we've been talking about exactly that, haven't we? I see what you're doing here. A bit of market research. I like it.
I could just see the look on Car Finance rep's eyes on his face when I told him that our average value of stock's gone down. He kind of, his face has drooped with like a lack of enthusiasm. It's like, oh, what? But, you know, if you can make the same margin on a $4,000 car than you can a 10, and ultimately, if you're selling that car on finance for 10 grand, your commission may only be sort of 150 quid, 200 quid. So am I really going to outlay double the amount of money to earn an extra, potentially earn an extra 100 quid or 200 in finance commission? No, I'm not going to tailor my whole business model towards selling cars on finance if I'm going to earn next to nothing in commission.
What value do you think people start going to wanting finance for? Because this is the question John and I are asking. I've been sort of pushing the stock value of mine up a little bit, retail price. I've got a Yaris coming in next week that will be just over 10 grand. So it's sort of the first one I've got over 10 grand. I sort of imagine that people will pay with a bank loan up to about 15 grand, I sort of think, and not want finance, but that's just a gut feeling. I mean, what's your experience tell you?
I'd say 10 grand plus. Anything 10 grand and over, people might be looking to finance all of it, right? Or even just 5 grand chunk of it, 6 grand chunk. What the car finance reps also will tell you, I don't know if you've had any approach you yet, but they'll always say, you know, going back to your comment about people will always get a bank loan. The car finance reps are very clever. What they'll tell you to tell the customers, you know, ultimately they might want to keep their line of credit with the bank open and free for anything they might want in life, like home improvements, extension, etc. So if you're going to go and get a bank loan for a car, you then don't have that line of credit open to do home improvements and stuff. So that's why they always try and advocate the use of car finance, because it's tied to the actual car, which enables them to still get 10, 20 grand maybe out for an extension. So that's quite a clever way to talk about car finance to customers.
So you think over 10 grand people, is it going to reduce my market for that car if it is just over 10 grand? Because I mean, everything I've sold so far has been just a simple bank transfer.
I think we spoke about it before. I would just bite the bullet, James. If you feel like you're in it for the long haul or even for the next sort of 2 or 3 years, I would just get FCA approved.
Yeah, get a site, get FCA approved.
Yeah, because you don't want to limit, you know, if you're feeling like you're going to start getting into the 10, 15, 20 grand stock, which will present itself to you at some point with decent margins, and it'll be very difficult to say no as you get the bug. You don't want to be limiting yourself because you're thinking, oh, no, I can't do that. People might want finance. Just get the license. I don't know how difficult it is or how costly it is these days, but I think for the long term, I wish I had done it earlier.
Good advice. Right, John, let's do some stories, shall we? And we can ask for many comments along the way.
Okie dokie. So James and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week. And at the end, Alex gets to decide who chose the best ones and who is the winner. Surprisingly, I won last week, so I'm going to start, although I'm immediately probably going to hand it back to James to talk about news from Big Motoring World. Been quite a bonanza of activity over there, if that's the right word. 6 new directors have been appointed to the car supermarket Big Motoring World, which is quite a few more than there were before. As I understand it, James, there were only 2 directors for the company before. And now there are 8. So this is after the slight turmoil that we've seen, if I can use that word, at Big Motoring World, where there was a slight disagreement over whether Peter Waddell had left or had not left. As far as Peter Waddell is concerned, he hasn't left. As far as Mr. Vaughan, whose other director, is concerned, he has taken a leave of absence, but is still employed by the company. So we're still kind of waiting to really understand what's going on here, but it's a bit peculiar, isn't it, James?
It is. I don't know if you can hear what I'm saying, but I might be many, many miles away, but my internet's terrible. But I picked up some of what you were saying, and I'm pretty sure it was about Big Motoring World and what's going on there.
Yes, that was the crux of the story.
Excellent,
thank you.
Excellent. Yeah, I have not been asleep. I just got terrible internet. I picked up this story Thursday morning, and The fact that they have added six new directors to that company, when before it was only Peter and Lawrence Vaughan, the executive chairman, says a lot. And you sort of have to read between the lines here. So there's clearly some internal wranglings going on there between Peter and the company. The company have said that they have that he is taking a leave of absence, not given any reason as to why. Peter told us that he's not taking a leave of absence, so clearly there's some arguments going on there. But I did some bit of investigation into this, and there's a complicated setup of how Big Motoring World is owned between some holding companies. But the ultimate holding company is called Bluebell, and that company, Bluebell Cars Bidco Limited, has the right to remove and appoint directors. So what they've clearly done is appointed six new directors. And if that was my business, I would be incredibly worried about that, because your voice is drowned out on the board. You've got clearly one voice when you are a director. And if there's seven others that don't agree with you, it's not easy to have motions carried. The complicated thing here is that Peter still owns 62% of Big Motoring World as a shareholder. What that means for how this situation gets resolved after that, probably going to end up in the hands of the lawyer. So I just think this is the reason this story was reported on is the fact that it says a lot, and you have to sort of read between the lines and guess. And I am sort of kind of alleging some things there and trying to see what's actually happening behind the scenes. But it points to a clear conflict behind the scenes. And I think this is just one that's going to rumble on and on and on and on and on. It's a difficult one to comment on, isn't it, this one, really?
Yes, I think we'll just have to keep our eyes peeled on that one.
Yeah. Hopefully, I haven't got into trouble with the lawyers. If I have, I'm very sorry. Shall I move us on, John?
Yes, and I'm sure that little disclaimer there will get you out of any legal action.
But what if somebody else comments on it and not you, James? Is that okay?
you possibly. Depends what they say, really. I mean, what do you think, Alex?
I think I picked up on a comment from Peter from previous. Now, he might say he didn't say that. But I read somewhere that he said that you should never go into business with someone else because that will only end up in tears or something like that.
His words were, don't take a partner.
Don't take a partner. Right. That was on our website because he said that in his headline interview at the Cardia Live event. Don't take a partner.
And we didn't know, we assumed at the time he was talking about his previous business venture. Was he? Who knows? Don't know.
Right, six directors. Do you need six to replace one? Maybe he had that much influence. I don't know. Maybe it sounds like we're on, I don't know, a female-led chat show instead.
Yeah. Let's move on. We'll let the listeners try and work out what's going on there. If they have got any ideas, answers on a postcard to the usual address. I am going to move on to more Close Brothers news. And this is the finance saga, the FCA's continuing probe into the car finance mis-selling. Close Brothers.
Their words, James. Actually, it's not their words. Martin Lewis's words.
FCA continues its probe into car finance mis-selling. Yes, their words. Their words indeed. So the Close Brothers updated the stock market this week with their half-year results and gave some more indication of how they are preparing for what could happen, any fallout from the FCA's investigation. They have set aside in some way, shored up their balance sheet to the tune of £400 million just in case of a heavy hit. They haven't specifically said that £400 million is to be set aside in case of any fines or anything that comes from the FCA. Lloyd's Banking Group's Black Horse has said that it's putting £450 million away in case it faces any payouts as a result of this. Close Brothers have done this in a slightly difficult roundabout way. They're scaling back some of their plans for growth in 2025 And they're also going to scrap their dividend again next year. You'll know we reported on it before. They've scrapped their dividend for this year to save them some multi-million pounds. So as a result, this means that they've now got tucked away on the balance sheet an extra 400 million just in case the FCA investigation causes problems for the lenders. This is a very difficult one to tackle, isn't it? We don't know what the FCA's investigation is going to throw up, but quite clearly there are some noises that there is going to have to be some compensation somewhere. The question at the moment comes down to where's that going to lie? Whose responsibility is that going to be? And at the moment, all fingers are pointing towards the lenders, but we don't know. What do you think?
I'm going to hand this over to Alex rather than me because you've almost said all my thoughts on this. But as someone who doesn't have any car finance, I mean, Alex, how do you feel about car finance currently? Because I know James and I have had this conversation about it must be quite difficult to be a car finance lender at the minute or even a broker. I mean, do you get the impression from customers that they're a little bit antsy, or are they not? They're just carrying, well, they wouldn't be antsy, would they? Because they're the ones getting the payout. But is there any kind of murmurings over it, or are they just not aware of any of this situation at the minute?
I've only had one customer come back to me and actually ask me for agreement details so they can then follow up with the lender. Hopefully this podcast doesn't, initiate anymore. But yeah, we've only had one customer. I mean, we did two or three deals with them, so... But their attitude is very much, you've got to be in it to win it. And you think, this is going to be the mentality of a lot of people that we're claiming through probably Martin Lewis's broadcasting more than anything else, I think. I'm pretty sure in the paperwork, though, throughout the last few years, that customers would have been issued with before going ahead with their agreement. There would have been something in there which would have prompted them to ask. And what I was very much told by the lenders is, if you're asked, or commission amounts that you'll be receiving as part of this deal, you must be telling them. And I'll be honest, not one customer ever asked. But of course, if they ever did, we would have been forthcoming and telling them exactly what commission payments we were receiving for brokering the deal. So I don't know the grounds and the basis for what FCA is saying. People may or may not have breached the rules, but it'd be interesting to know when the outcomes are released.
It's the not knowing, isn't it? I think on this one and I think it's the fact that nobody knows whether the responsibility is going to lie with the lender or whether the dealers are going to have to stump up any cash as part of that. And I think this is the bit that really got these stories so much interest around them, is because people are just worried and really worried about how this one's going to play out.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, colour preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
John, move us on.
Okay, I'm going to move us on to car thefts. And for once, I'm not talking about Range Rovers. So it looks a little bit like, I will explain this. I'll preface this by saying it's not as bad as the Range Rover situation, I would say. But this is... We've reported on a report from Watchdog, BBC Watchdog, highlighting thefts of Toyota and Lexus vehicles. We've said in the title, keyless theft problems. What I would say is it's not really keyless. It's keyless in the sense that I don't think cars with an ignition barrel are affected by this. But it's not keyless in the sense that somebody's standing between your house and the car with some sort of booster in the way that most of these keyless thefts work. What seems to be happening here is that there is a security flaw in the way that some of these Toyotas and Lexuses have been assembled, which means that there's a way, using this very expensive tool that you can buy off the internet, there's a way of unlocking the vehicle and starting it by removing, let's say, the headlight and plugging directly into the CAN bus of the, you know, this computer cabling system that runs all the way around the car and does everything from lighting to ignition to radio and all this stuff. So criminals have found a way of exploiting that, and all they do is take the headlight out and plug their magic box in, which has been disguised, as I understand it, as a little Bluetooth JBL speaker. So if they're stopped by the police, they can go, this is a Bluetooth speaker. This is not really? Some sort of
car. Plugged into your front end.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that might be slightly harder.
Mark Levinson premium audio isn't good enough.
Yeah, I really need it at just the front quarter of the car. But yeah, so this has been a bit of a problem. And we've seen a couple of cars being stolen this way. I think it started in London, as these things often do. All the trends start in London, don't they? Whether it's cronuts or car thefts. And then they're sort of escalating out from there. The good news is for Toyota owners, it doesn't seem to be many cars. So Toyota have actually published a story on their Toyota UK magazine explaining how all this works and what they're doing about it. But the cars that they've got affected are the Land Cruiser between certain years, the RAV4, but not the plug-in hybrid RAV4, between certain years, and the CHR. And I think there's a sort of a few Lexuses as well, the RX and the NX. I mean, quite what the criminals are doing with those Lexus RXs, because they're incredibly slow to sell, apparently, according to recent data. I don't know, but this is one of those things where probably they're packaged off and sent off to another land in a container somewhere once they've been nicked or indeed stripped for parts. So one thing I will say about this is Toyota seem to be doing something about it a bit quicker than JLR are. So they're not issuing a recall because I don't know why they're not issuing a recall as such, but what they're offering is a free fix, which seems to involve putting some sort of security plate in to stop crims accessing the bits that they need to access. But the reason I want to talk about this, because this is not, it's only Toyota being affected here, but Toyota is one of the world's biggest car manufacturers, and therefore probably they were a nice easy target for criminals to start making devices of this nature. I wonder if we're going to see more of stuff like this, where you can pop out a bit of the car, or you can somehow access these cables and plugs that run all the way around the car. And because cars these days are, if you think about a car from 20 years ago, it had two little cables running into the headlight that had nothing to do with anything else. They just went straight to the battery. Nowadays, headlights, for example, plug into the car's ECU or one of its many ECUs, because they have all these adaptive lights and all that sort of stuff. So what you do is effectively open up a security flaw. So I wonder if we'll see more and more of this occurring.
Did you watch the Watchdog program?
I didn't, James, because I had other things to be doing at that time of the evening.
Because it's now on the One Show, so obviously...
see my previous point, yeah.
Perfect time to watch it. But no, I did watch it back because I wrote this story, I think. The thing that amazed me is just how quick these people stole these cars. You know, even though they had to get in underneath the wheel arch and plug into this system, it was very, very quick. And one of the people who had their cars plural stolen lost two of them off the drive in a matter of seconds, really. It was scary, and no wonder they've tried to try and fix this problem as quickly as possible. I think the Watchdog's biggest beef was the fact that they haven't issued a recall for this, and consumers have to contact their local dealer and say, is my car one of the ones affected? And if so, they can then get this new hardened panel that stops the crims, as you put it, John, getting access to the car.
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned no recall, because I can tell you from the Toyota website, they've got a heading, why is there no recall for vehicles susceptible to the CAN bus attack, is what they've called it. Recall announcements in the UK are guided by very specific guidelines drawn up by the DVSA to qualify as a recall, blah, 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 blah. So it's they're pointing the finger at the DVSA, because this is not a safety issue as such. It's a theft issue, which is slightly different.
Alex, have you had any problems with thefts at your site? Any issues of people targeting your stock?
No, our stock's not very desirable, so we're pleased to say. We do keep the older Hondas within the compound and locked and secured, just in case anybody wants to nick a 500-pound cat off a 1,000-pound Jazz. I guess that can still happen. Locally, we had a Fiesta stolen. That's just run-of-the-mill, keyless entry stuff, which just coincided with the same evening my friend's Mercedes being stolen from Petersfield. But they're just random links. I think it's interesting that Toyota have come out straight away. I think whenever there's like an airbag recall or a safety recall or anything like this, which gives them the chance to actually come to the fore and show how good their customer service is, they do it really well. I might just be saying actually I spent a year there, placement year when I was at uni, but yeah, it doesn't surprise me that they've acted on it swiftly. Mm. They're always good with stuff like that in my experience. But yeah, it's scary, isn't it? I think the more advanced all these cars become, and all the different modules and CAN bus systems, the CRIMs, as you say, are going to be on it just as quick. So it is quite scary. Maybe it is a sign of things to come. So we'll always be up against it, I think.
Yeah. Right, I'll move us on. I have got a story here from Bentley. And this is Bentley performing a little bit of a U-turn. We like a U-turn on the podcast, don't we?
And John? Bentley's performing U-turns. You need quite a big road to do so.
You do, yes.
But this is big money.
Yeah, very good. This is Bentley performing a U-turn far quicker than their actual cars on a pledge to stop ICE manufacturing by 2030. So they were due to become all electric by 2030, which was obviously in line with the previous ban on petrol and diesel cars. But they've now rode back on that. We love a little row back. And this is Bentley saying that actually due to an increase in demand for their hybrid models following the government's change from 2030 to 2035, it's prompted it to have a little bit of a rethink over its all-out switch to electrification, says John Bowman on the Car Dealer Magazine website. So what they're actually going to be doing is quite clearly not stopping the production of some of these hybrid vehicles, because people, funnily enough, still want them. So the reason I picked this story is I just wonder whether this is just the start of a little trend that we're going to see with some others. We've had some other manufacturers out there promise that they're going to become all electric, and we have clearly seen that demand is dropping off for that. Just as a slight aside, I was sent a advert for a well-known car manufacturer, Audi. I'm just going to ask, let's see. I know I've asked this to you, John, already last night, but let's see if Alex can guess what the deposit contribution at the moment for an Audi e-tron GT Quattro is. Any idea how much you'll get from the dealer stroke manufacturer as a deposit contribution?
Something crazy, like $5,000 or something.
Well, you would think something crazy like $5,000, wouldn't you? But no, I will show you. It is £28,000. £28,861 deposit contribution on an $85,000 car. I mean,
they're basically giving away half of their margin just to get them sold and out the door.
If anything shows you that consumers are not particularly interested in EVs, it is that. I mean, that is scary, isn't it? When you see those sorts of, I mean, I have never in my life seen a deposit contribution quite to that sort of level. I mean, it's an incredible rate
of interest, James. Maybe it's like 35% APR.
Like my credit cards. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think this just all ties in with a little bit of a worry for electric vehicles. I mean, Alex, I remember when we came to see you for that YouTube video, which is on our YouTube channel right now, plug over, you had a wonderful little Citroen Ami. So you clearly do like electric cars.
That's not really an electric car, is it? Well, I don't know. It's not really an electric car, is it? That's sort of like...
No, it's a quadricycle.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
Officially. I do like an electric car. I think mainly because we've got electric built into our premises rent here. But that aside, we do love an electric car. There's quite a few small electric cars out now, isn't there? You've got the Zoe, the Ami, which is a quadricycle. We've got the Vauxhall Stellantis platform with the Corsa and the E208. And we've sold quite a few E208s now, two or three, and they've always sold quite well. So yeah, that helps us to stock, you know, the more expensive hatch because there aren't many around really, apart from the Abarth. There's not many sort of 15. What, the electric ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. They all sold within sort of like a month or so, which good, for us is quite good.
Yeah, because yeah. Auto Trader said, didn't they, Cardia Live, that on average, electric vehicles were selling 10 days quicker than ICE cars.
Yeah. So that's enough of an incentive, if any, to stop them and take advantage of what I suspect out there in the used car dealer world. People probably still putting it off because they haven't got charge point at the forecourt premises, and maybe they're just a little bit apprehensive themselves. But they should really get over that and get with the times. I think start was dipping toe in the water. Margin, same if not more than a nice car. I think, yeah. Yeah, I think it's important to try and find something a little bit niche. Of course, we've got loads now coming off PCP lease and things like that with sort of 8, 10, 15,000 miles on. And then you're going to be up against it, against the like of, you know, Big Motoring World and Big Boy Cinch, maybe not Cazoo so much anymore as they're dwindling down stock. But yeah, if you can get a more higher mileage, older electric vehicle with not that many around competition-wise, then yeah, I think you do well. We sold our design red cloth or Ann Summers red interior, as you called it, John, Smart 4.2, which was fully electric. And that sold quite quickly as well. Again, there's not many of those around. There's only two or three on Auto Trader. So be clever with what you're buying. I think you'll do well out of it.
Mm-hmm. I tried to buy a Citroen Ami myself the other week, but my offer was turned down. I only offered $4,000 for it. So and it was on a 70.
Yeah, I did a similar thing. I don't think they're that desperate to get rid.
No, but quite fancy having one.
Yeah, $4,000, you can't go wrong. They're new, what, eight grand new, probably put up a little bit more, so half price.
That particular one had only done about 100 miles, didn't it? And they'd
590 miles, and Auto Trader retail rating of 10.
Yeah, I was gonna say that'd be quite low.
Wasn't really in my buying profile, but still, I did try to do it anyway.
But you could fit it in your garage quite easily. You could fit three of them in your garage, actually.
Yeah. True.
I'll leave it parked on a local road and get it wrapped or painted with James Buys Cars.
Sell your cars to James.com.
There you go.
Sell your car to James.com. Coming soon.
I should mention James is thinking of having a billboard printed with his face on it in the local area opposite the KFC.
Good idea. Honestly, it's worth trying. Yeah.
I think if only for the lols.
Right. Honestly, I think you do well. Genuinely consider doing a similar thing on like one of the local digital billboards. Yeah,
let's try it. We'll see who's most successful. See who gets defaced first.
Yeah,
put it right outside We Buy Any Car.
Oh yeah, I mean this is a viral video in the making. I like it. Right, John, I think that was my story, wasn't it? Was that mine?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Over to you.
I will give some positive news. This is a story commenting what the IGA have said about something the government has done. But basically, the government has announced that they are planning to create up to 20,000 more apprenticeships than there currently are, presumably. So this is £60 million of investment. And the idea is the government will pay the full costs of apprenticeships for under 21-year-olds in small businesses from April the 1st. So the idea being that it will get more apprentices into businesses and reduce the financial burden on employers. And as a flip side of that, all these young people get trained in whatever it is that they're going to be doing.
Really? I did not see this story. That is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we our apprenticeships have. We have taken on apprentices, haven't we, James?
It has been quite successfully. Been very, very successful. Yeah, we've had four or five, and I think four of them. Well, I mean, one of them only left the company last week after, 6 years, I think it was? 6 years with us. So, yeah.
We let him out of his cage and off he flew.
And off he went. Flew off into the distance like a real boy. The apprentices have always been great. I think that's just a fantastic way of giving people a chance and actually a great way of training someone up in your mold and someone who can really, really learn your business. And actually, they're incredibly grateful to be given the opportunity. And actually, you get a very, very loyal employee off the back of it. So yeah, I actually missed that news. And I'm now going to go and look at more apprentices because if they're going to be paying the full cost, I mean, before it was 90% they paid, I think, and you paid 10%. I mean, that is very, very much worth investigating.
Yeah, and I think that's great news. For, well, the IGA have commented, of course, on the motor trade's point of view. That's great news for the motor trade because we are facing a massive skills shortage, aren't we, really? And a lack of, I don't want to use the word talent because that implies that nobody's talented, but we're missing people, aren't we? We're missing humans to do these jobs, particularly in technician roles. So anything along those lines that can help is great.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about taking on an apprentice, Alex?
Yeah, I have actually. And is it just technician roles which they are opening up?
No, I think it's just...
Because obviously neither of us read the proper actual announcement. Yeah. But, you know, I think anything... I don't know if apprenticeships go as far as, say, sales. I don't know if that is a thing. But I think it's usually... I mean, we had them for journalism, didn't we, James? I think there has to be an element of learning alongside it. I don't see why you couldn't do it from a business management-y point of view, but I mean, this is just me.
No, but as a technician for your business, I mean,
yeah, as a technician,
great,
or
great way of getting a second person.
Yeah, so you'd have to actually give them an element of training on the job, I'd imagine. Which, if there's no current skill set within the business to help and aid them, it might be quite difficult, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
I don't know. But yeah, something I thought about. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I think it's how a lot of us have probably got into the role and the position that we're in now is just through taking on apprenticeships or short-term roles or internships and whatnot. So,
well, a lot of the incredibly high up people in the motor trade started that way. You know, you look at people like, I want to say Andy Palmer. I couldn't tell you whether he's actually an apprentice, but he started very low end in Rover and all these things. Who else am I thinking of? Darren Edwards was a paint sprayer, apprentice sprayer, I think.
Yeah.
And there he is running Sittner.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a great way, definitely something that people should be investigating. John, I am out of stories, I'm afraid. So,
really?
I am. Yeah.
I'll slot one more in while we've got a bit of time. What shall I go on to? I'm just going to quickly chat about Nissan and Honda, who have joined forces. I mean, this is very loosely joining forces, but Nissan and Honda have joined forces, says our story, on developing electric vehicles and AI, your favorite thing, for cars. So the CEOs of Nissan and Honda, the big CEOs in Japan, have appeared together at this news conference in Tokyo and have announced they've signed a non-binding memorandum of understanding, which is my favorite nonsense business term. But basically, they are looking to work together to try and, I don't want to say beat the competition, but they're trying to face off strong competition from China, let's be honest, and Tesla. I mean, they are both, well, okay, they're both. Nissan is very strong in EVs, but even they are struggling to get products out into market. I mean, here in the UK, they've just stopped making the Leaf, haven't they, in advance of starting to make the new Leaf and new other electric cars. But at the minute, they've got one electric car on sale in the UK. In Japan, they've got probably three. They're not massively far ahead for a manufacturer that kicked it all off, really, with proper production EVs. They're not very far ahead of everyone else at the minute. Renault, their partner, are doing quite well, I suppose. Honda, not really doing particularly well. They've got one or two cars on sale, depending on who you ask. So for them to tie up together and, you know, combine efforts on these things, I think is needed. I think they desperately need to get ahead of the game. It's a bit like, you know, we covered stories about Renault, I think. Stellantis. Various European car manufacturers have said the same thing, that they need to join forces, possibly, to fend off the might of Chinese automakers. So this is just another one in the line of that vein, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're going to need... I think that's the thing that hits the nail on the head, really, is the fact that these two, what were bitter rivals, really, Nissan and Honda, joining forces on collaborating to develop electric vehicles because they feel there's no other way of doing it. I mean, I think that's the real story here, isn't it? They can see the threat that's coming from the Chinese and other areas of the industry and think, we need to do something. And that's collaborating with a company that we would rather not be talking to.
Yeah, I will say this is not that unusual for Japanese companies. It sounds unusual to us, but I I know they have lots of in the background, and certainly for years previously have been quite good at talking to each other and sharing technologies and all this sort of stuff. There's weird things like in my Subaru, fun fact for you there, the window switches are from Nissan, because once upon a time Subaru and Nissan had a bit of an understanding of sharing bits and pieces. Strange but true.
Here you have this window switch, and you can have this gear lever cover. Here you go.
That's right. Yeah.
What a trade. What a
Otherwise, trade. Nothing else.
Yeah.
That's it. Well, I'm going to stop talking there before I go into what else is shared on my Subaru with other Nissans.
Please do.
Alex, before we ask your verdict, are there any stories we've missed this week?
I think you've probably have picked out some of the best ones. I mean, on a personal level, I'm one of these sad people, maybe a bit like you with your Subaru comment just then, that I quite enjoy sitting on YouTube and watching videos of abandoned sites, whether it's car dealerships or whacking great big mansions in London. I quite enjoyed the one about the abandoned used car dealership where cars have been left half repaired, which reminds me back to another video which may have disappeared since. I've not been able to enjoy it because I've lost it, but there was one on a massive airfield. I think it might have even been like Milton Keynes Way, where they had all of the scrappage scheme cars just abandoned. That caught my eye. I guess they've long gone now, but yeah, I quite enjoyed the one, and that was quite a recent one. It's only 3 hours ago. That might be why you guys haven't picked up on it. But I think that was a car dealership in Germany, where, yeah, apparently they just had to up sticks and leave. But obviously, some of the not-so-nice people of the world went in and have now robbed all the decent car bits. But yeah, just looking at old cars kind of in time warp condition, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I wrote that story, actually, because I was very similar when I watched the video. It's actually a really good video. But just really strange. It's like all the files in the cabinet on all the shelves are still full of all the paperwork. The parts warehouse is still full of all the like loads of parts, bumpers, wheels, like all the shelves are still stocked. I'm surprised it hasn't all been nicked. But yeah, clearly the cars have been attacked for parts. The ones in the showroom have had rear lamps stolen and bits nicked from underneath the bonnet, and all the wheels have gone. But apparently what had happened is it was owned by two brothers who fell out. Off the back of that, they closed down the showroom immediately. And since then haven't been able to sort it out. So it's just been run into disrepair. I'd just love to know how these YouTube channels, this one is called Forgotten Buildings. That's the YouTube channel where you can find the video. I just wonder how they hear about these things. Because these, and also they've just, I think this guy is Dutch, and he's obviously traveled over to Germany purely just to go and film this video at this German car dealership.
I think a lot of it's tip-off, you know. I think because they've built such a following and got so many subscribers, you know, the subscribers are kind of into it as much as the people creating the video. So if they're thinking, oh, we know someone would be great for them to come in, like maybe they haven't got the technology or the know-how or the want, desire to go in themselves and film it. If they give them a tip-off and they then think it's interesting enough, they will, jump country to go and film it, and then obviously get the views and the subscribers and the and off the back of it. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, I'm going to have to ask you, that was a very good story, but we haven't talked about it at all. I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories? Who is the winner?
Ooh, I quite enjoyed the Big Motoring World story. Yeah, because I just think there's not that... Who was that? It was you, John.
It was me. I mean,
yeah, I thought it was
a win because it's James's story, but I'll take it. I don't care.
Okay, double win. I just think there's not so many characters in the industry as what there could be, and I think Peter comes across as certainly one of those. So yeah, I quite enjoyed that. Yeah.
Oh, I'll let you have the win again, John.
Sorry. Oh. You can win one when you're back in
you
6
wrote
weeks.
It. So that's fine.
I wrote it. Yeah, that's fine. Oh,
did write it.
Take
you
second,
did write.
Second place. Right, I'll go off and sulk for 6 to 8 weeks, and I'll see you after that.
The painkillers will help.
Yeah.
Well, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Alex for judging today. It's been lovely to have you on, and good to see you again. And thank you for letting us invade your premises and distract you from actually doing business for about 4 hours.
Good. We did do some business on the back of it, actually. Thanks to James.
Really?
So it's all good. It's all reciprocal. Yeah. Yeah, we sold an Evoke the other day.
Yeah, to one of my followers on Instagram who went and watched the video, saw that Alex was local, went off and saw a Carnage show and bought a car from as a result. So yeah, I take my commission check will be in the post.
Yeah, it was sent recorded this morning, so there's no excuses.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Very good. Well, if you're listening and you'd like James to come and promote your dealership, do get in touch. We're always happy to do so, and he takes a very small fee.
Usual fee.
Thank you as well to James for, managing to sit down without going for about 10 minutes, which is what he's been doing all week. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with, I assume, our very own Quentin Wilson, James Batchelor, for another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Also, remember to like and subscribe or whatever
is
on your particular Spotify, Apple podcasting, whatever this is, listen to. Good. Okay. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.